We'll start with the approval of the minutes. Did somebody get a chance to read through the minutes? I know I did, but I'm not going to be the one to make the motion.
I'll move to approve the minutes of our May 28th, 2025 Council of Governments meeting.
I will second it.
Motion made and seconded. Is there any question? All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, great. I'm going to move on to our WSDOT presentation, I hope. And I guess we need an introduction from somebody on who's attending and how it's going to go. And John, why don't you see how many seats you can take or who wants to speak first and come on up here. Where are you going, Martin? Oh, okay.
Brian, all right. Go over by now.
Great. Okay. And then
Cheers, I think.
No. Okay, all right. You don't want to come up. Yeah, you can come on up. Always enjoy having the history here. A little more legacy, all the legacy we can get. The reason that I put this back on, I know that extra agendas. I'm good. We have time. We worked it out. See, we knew we needed you for something. That's good. Up here, sitting up here. Yeah. Nice work.
Good job, Megan.
Okay, so part of the motivation for a conversation about the bridge came, there's been comments to the IRTPO, and there have been other preparedness comments, emergency management comments. So I felt like the Council of Government could take this on as opposed to transportation. For more than one reason, and one is, you know, the lifeline piece, and the other is the WSDOT piece in terms of transportation. So looking forward to hearing what you all have to say, but I'd like to start with some introductions, some self-introductions.
My name's Evan Grimm. I work for WSDOT, and I'm the state bridge engineer. So my job is statewide responsibilities for the safety of the structures, the inspections, design. We do the bridge design, design policy. And before I move on, is there a Wi-Fi?
Yeah. Oh, it's we go best. That's the one.
Well, she's got all these working now, doesn't she?
Okay. Oh, okay. Thank you.
So you're Evan.
Evan.
Okay.
I'm Caleb Grayson. I'm the Northwest Region Emergency Manager for WSDOT, which encompasses Island County. So we're about King County border, Pierce County border, up to Canadian border, Mountain Pass to...
Emergency Management for WSDOT. Okay. Yes. Wow. Thank you.
Thanks.
Then Chris Demichaud, and I'm the Assistant Regional Administrator for the Department of Transportation for this area.
Thanks for coming, Chris.
Hey, everybody. Brian Tyhouse from Naval Air Station.
Okay. Anyway, and we have the city administrator today. What's your name again?
Sabrina. That's right. Introduced.
I'm glad she's here. And Malcolm's here with the Port of Coopville.
Martin.
Yeah, next week. I'll let you run that one. How about that? And we have our county commissioners, and I'm Kirk Gordon. Is there somebody online that we should also? Oh, John Shambaugh's on. Morning, John. We could unmute him, but that's all right. Hey, John, right. Thanks for helping me put some of this together. Give me some leads.
Yep.
Kurt, this is Janet. There are two other WSDOT employees online as well.
Speak out, folks.
Good morning, Justin Resnick. I'm the Planning and Engineering Services Manager for the WSDOT Mount Baker area. Good to see everybody.
Thanks for coming.
And good morning, everyone. I'm Ryan Clemens. I'm with the WSDOT Tribal and Regional Integrated Planning Team at WSDOT headquarters.
Great. Thanks. We got a stacked group in here today. So who wants to kick this off?
Well, I guess I'll go ahead and just open it up and reiterate, as you said, there's been a lot of discussion about the deception bridges, resilience, life, and life.
Thank you. So yeah, there's been a lot of discussion recently about the deception and canoe pass bridges and how they fit into sustainability, resilience, and the lifeline aspect of them. And so, yes, we brought in our experts, Kayla and Evan, to talk about that today. So I'll turn it over to them. They have a PowerPoint. And is that available online?
I'm trying to get to the Zoom meeting.
I've got a thumb drive.
I just need to be able to get, oh, there it is, Zoom. I'm almost there.
Okay.
This has been the... And then I can share it.
Awesome. And yeah, they've got a presentation at the end. We'd love to take questions. And
we brought Eric Brooks in too. And so we'll have a little bit of conversation.
Yeah.
Like our questions
at the
end.
I'm very informal, so feel free to ask during the presentation.
Whatever you're comfortable with.
Depends on how long Evan talks.
I was planning to do 10 minutes on my side.
Maybe 15 minutes, 20, 15, 20. Okay.
I don't know. Okay. Okay,
I'm almost there. Okay, I've got the PowerPoint pulled up. I'm in the meeting, so now I just have to share my screen. Share screen. Share. Okay, great. All right. So, what we want to talk about was, I'll start out, as we said, and then Kayla. So I'll be talking about bridge conditions statewide and how deception and canoe pass kind of fit into that, and talk a little bit about our seismic retrofit program. And again, talk about the seismic sort of condition situation on deception and canoe passes. And then we'll transition from there into kind of the seismic lifeline. And that's where Kayla will take over and talk about more on the emergency response side of things. And these preliminary damage assessments she'll tell you more about. So we, Washington State Department of Transportation, we're responsible for the bridges that are on the state highways, directly responsible for managing them, inspecting them, making sure they're functioning properly. The local agencies are all responsible for their own bridges. And the WSDOT has a large variety of structure types. We have a lot of run-of-the-mill overpass bridges, bridges over rivers and stuff, and we have large structures. You look at downtown Seattle, the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, suspension bridges, floating bridges, so large tunnels. So we have a unique inventory and a lot to cover. Just to give you a flavor for our overall condition of our inventory, we have 3,400 bridges, and the average age is 51 years of our bridges. And the oldest is 1915, based on our best records. And we have of bridges, what you can see here is we've kind of grouped them by age. So of bridges that are over 80 years and older, we have 313 of those. So our bridge inventory is aging. Wanted to just give you a flavor for the condition, and this is a step in to help you understand. So every bridge is inspected on an average of every 2 years. And our bridge inspectors, they're collecting all kinds of detailed information. In addition to that, they're also giving an overall rating of the deck, of the superstructure and the substructure. So each of those gets rated on a scale from 0 to 8, 0 being it's completely failed and collapsed, and 8 being it's in the best condition. And if you look at how those break out, if the superstructure, let's say, is in a 7 or an 8, then the bridge is, the superstructure is considered good condition. And, or the same thing goes for substructure and deck. So 6 and 5 are fair and 4 and below are poor. And if any, and the entire bridge condition is then governed by the lowest of those. So if you have a deck that's in poor condition and the superstructure and substructure are in fair condition, then you would say the lowest is poor, so the bridge is poor condition. So just to kind of give you a flavor. And poor condition does not necessarily mean that it's unsafe or anything like that. That the reason we have a robust program for inspection is to ensure that our bridges are safe. Poor would mean that these conditions give you a sense for how much work is needed to perform repairs or maintenance or preservation activities on them. So if it's poor condition, it just means it's going to cost you more money to bring it up into a better condition state through repair projects or rehab projects. So where do we rank? Well, we've got, by, if you look at deck area, then 8.5% of our bridges are in poor condition, 55% are fair, and 36% are in good condition. And if you just look at poor, this graph, what it's showing you is kind of where we've been at over the last few years, overall bridge condition. So our 3,400 bridges, we've been hovering around 7%, getting it up most recently in the 8% range of poor. And we're, these dashed lines are into the future are predictions. So we have pretty complex deterioration modeling and future modeling. The blue line would be if you did no preservation work of any kind. That's about how fast we would continue to deteriorate. And the green line is giving current, approximate current funding for our preservation program. We will continue to deteriorate, just not as quickly. And the red line, the reason I put that in there is because this 10% is this threshold that Federal Highway Administration caps for the states. And they say, if you get over 10% poor for your bridges, then that's going to trigger, basically, they're going to identify that as a problem, and they're going to have more control over the preservation money that comes into our state. They're going to say more of the money that we give you has to go towards preservation of bridges, that kind of thing. So it's just good to be aware that we're more than likely going to hit that. And there's really no way to stop that from happening. Even if we got, you know, just all the money we could ever want, it's going to take time to turn this ship, because it's taken us decades of underfunding to get us to this condition that we're in now, which is not a good place. In order to actually turn this around so that we're actually reducing the percentage of poor bridges, you have to have a significant amount of funding over a long period of time. And then you have to get that money programmed to projects, and then those projects designed and then built. And then you go out and inspect it again, and you find out that the condition's starting to get better. That's years just to go through that process. So there's this inertia in there. And my main point is to help you get a sense for how big of a challenge we're facing. These are just a few examples, and I tried to kind of spread them across the state, but I could talk for hours about challenges we have in our condition. The Tacoma Narrows Bridge, the 1950 bridge, it's a huge investment, and we should be maintaining it. We're not. And if you've seen anything in the news or if you drive across it at all, we're out there closing every few months. We're making closures to make repairs to the deck or to bridge expansion joints. And it's frustrating, and it's embarrassing. I mean, we need to be spending a lot more money on that structure. It's a huge investment. The Fairfax Bridge, or also known as the Carbon River Bridge on State Route 165. This is, you've probably seen this one in the news, where we actually closed the bridge, and we closed it due to condition deterioration. It got so bad, it's a steel bridge, and we weren't painting it. And when you don't paint steel, it rusts. And when steel rusts, it actually loses its material. So you get to the point where a thin piece of steel gets thinner and thinner, and it just gets weak. And we got to the point on this bridge where we had to actually close it. And so this, more of this is coming. And what happened here is we cut off a community on the south of this bridge. They don't have access to garbage collection. They have a very challenging detour through private roads to get through. So it's really emergency access only. The Ship Canal Bridge on I-5, you've probably seen that in the news as well. This is just one picture of how bad the deck is getting. And you can see all the repairs. You can imagine how many hours and hours of work our maintenance crews are putting into this that they could be spending on other work that is more your typical maintenance activities to clean the shoulders and keep guardrail up and functioning and those kind of things. And then over in Spokane, just a couple of years ago, we had a pedestrian bridge going over I-90 that we had to actually demolish and close because the condition was so bad that we were worried it was going to potentially collapse and land on traffic on I-90. And then this is a map. This map is a little bit, kind of a lot going on here, but it's to give you a sense for the bridges that are due for immediate needs or are coming due for immediate needs. And the size of the circle gives you a sense for how bad the detour needs are. So the bigger the circle, the greater the detour length. So just you can just kind of get a flavor for how widespread our challenges are across the state. And this is bridges only. I'm not even talking about roads. That's another presentation. So let's talk about Deception and Canoe Pass. These bridges were built in 1935, and they are what we call a steel deck truss. Each of them has a steel truss, and they have these concrete approach spans. Beautiful bridges, and very important, obviously. They're on this non-redundant route, the only way in or out, at least using vehicles and driving over bridge-wise. They are in fair condition. The Deception Pass Bridge is just starting to get into poor now. And again, that doesn't mean it's unsafe. Just it means that it's that the cost to make repairs is going to continue to get increase is what that means. But it's also important to recognize with a 90-year-old bridge, it's starting to get in a fair into poor condition. That's an indication to us as bridge managers that this bridge is not going to continue to last forever. It will need to be replaced. And we don't have a program in place yet for replacement, but it's going to eventually need to be replaced. There's all kinds of needs on it. It's a big old structure, like all of our structures. If you looked at the inspection report, you would see needs for repairing cracks, and there's rust. And we just recently did a painting project on this just a few years ago. So we've arrested, you know, the rust that was happening. But nevertheless, there's, even though we replaced some of the steel, we put plate back where plate was resting, there's still those issues in areas where we weren't able to get it all. There's deck drain repairs needed. So we have a whole list, and we work with our maintenance crews on these things. And then things that they can't do, we try to get into a project if we can afford it. And it's being washed. That's another part of our program. The maintenance crews wash it so that we can see everything. We can't see it, we can't inspect it. So that's just an indication that it is safe to drive on, but it's getting older. And this is, I'm kind of switching gears. So this is a challenging topic here, but I just want to point out that we have been asked to do a study. Now, this is related to, unfortunately, the tragedies that have happened at the structure with people losing their lives. And there's a recent, I don't have it written in front of me, but there's a recent bill that was passed that's charged WashDOT with doing a study to look at how much would it cost and what might it look like to do some kind of deterrence. And on the right side, I've just got an example that is kind of our starting point that we'll probably start looking at, which is the Aurora Avenue Bridge in Seattle. And this fence that you can see, that's got those vertical lines on it, that was the solution there, was to put that up. And so we'll be working on that. Our office, we'll be looking at the structural impacts and, you know, how much it might cost. Would we have to strengthen parts of the structure to be able to connect a fence? What are some of the solutions? What fences or other, you know, type of elements, what they might look like? And we're going to be working with the Northwest region. They've got a really solid group of environmental and historical people who will look at some of those impacts as well. So that should be happening in the next 2 years, and we'll see what comes out of that. But hopefully it'll give us a sense for how big the project might be. Okay, so we talked about condition and this term preservation. It's kind of like maintenance, but it's more the big picture stuff you have to do. You know, you might maintaining might be painting your house ever so often, and the preservation side might be, well, sometimes you have to go and replace some siding or replace your roof, that kind of stuff. So within the preservation bucket of money, that is, as you can tell, where it's a very limited bucket, that's why we're not able to keep up with everything. It covers not just condition, but also these risk kind of based issues. One of them would be vessel collision. You saw the damage and the collapse that happened in Baltimore and the Key Bridge in March of last year. And we've got those same risks, especially on the Columbia River. There's two bridges particularly that the pilots, Columbia River pilots, are very concerned about, and they want us to take some action. They want us to put some barriers up and to protect those structures, because we have just as big a ships as they had in Baltimore that traverse under our structures, and bigger ships, and they do lose power sometimes. So that's a very big, you know, that's tens, hundreds of millions of dollars and probably billions when you look across our entire inventory. And seismic is another risk. So these are, you look at condition, you look at all the problems in the pictures I showed you, and those are happening now. Those are today's problems that we need to address. And then you look at these probability-based events that they could happen, they likely will happen, but they're not now, but when are they gonna happen? We don't know. So all those things have to be addressed in the same limited funding. And we have the seismic retrofit program, and it looks across, what we've done was we looked across all the bridges in the state that were in sort of a higher sort of seismic shaking risk category, that mainly Western Washington, where the higher accelerations are to happen. And we generated, we went through and we looked at all those structures and which of them were built after the time period that seismic design started to become more common within our bridges. So the mid 80s is when we started to really modify our design codes. So anything that was built before that. And then you go and you look through there and you can identify what might be vulnerable. And so we have certain approaches that we take for typical bridges. We call it, where we'll put a steel, we call it a jacket. It's like putting a steel can around a column and a concrete column and filling that space with grout. And it grabs on that column to make sure that if the bridge starts to shake, that column will not fail and shear, will not collapse. So we have these, we've identified the bridges, we have identified the types of work that needs to be done, and we've identified, you know, approximately how much it will cost. And we're just working our way through that list right now. So you can see that we've identified 918, we've completely retrofitted 330, and we still have 588 to go. So we're marching down through. I can tell you we did zero last year, we did zero the year before, and the year before that, we did probably about 15 to 20 on the I-405, I-90 area. So as funding becomes available, we're able to make strides towards this program. And when it's not available, we don't do it. And I think this is my last slide, but I wanted to just talk a little bit about the Deception and Canoe Pass bridges. They're a little unique. We can't just look at them and say, oh, we're going to do column jacketing. Because of the size and the nature of the structure, we actually had to do an analysis. And so one of our engineers put together this analysis in 2019 and actually looked more closely at the structure. And he identified the vulnerabilities on it. There's a statement in there, and I can't read my notes exactly, but one of the statements he has is that it will generally perform well during an earthquake, but there are deficiencies. And I don't have that exact statement I'd have to look it up. But so the idea being that he's not concerned about impending collapse. However, there are some vulnerabilities. For example, the bearings, so where the bridge kind of touches down at those two main piers in the water, those bearings, he would like to encapsulate those, strengthen those so that if the bridge had a seismic wave hit it, the bridge can't, slip on that bearing. It holds it in place. So there's a few things like that. There's some strengthening of members that were recommended. And so we've got and he put a cost estimate in there. Now the cost estimate's a few years old by now, so we need to update that. But it's really helpful just to give us a sense for what's needed at the structure. Now we use this, we put this together more for us internally as an engineering analysis. I know this has been put up in the public space and I've seen articles and newspapers about it. It's kind of hard to make sense of it if you're not an engineer. So it really wasn't intended to be an emergency management document. It was just really intended for us to be able to identify as structural engineers, what should be done, what would we want to do? And so we've got those identified. So this bridge will be on the list of structures needing retrofit, and it's waiting like a lot of other structures. And now another piece that will, so it's not programmed now, but it hopefully will eventually be programmed. And this will switch over to Kayla's presentation. And I just want to point out that, I'll let her talk about the seismic lifeline and how that fits in.
Okay. So people talk about the lifeline a lot. Seismic lifeline is something that's just like made up by us. It's not set in stone necessarily anywhere. It is not some legal thing. It was developed to connect the federal distribution points near Seattle. So it connects Painfield to JBLM, to SeaTac, and across I-90 to Moses Lake. That is the seismic lifeline. I put a map up here that you can see. It's kind of hard to see in this light, but the light green there is the seismic lifeline. And that's all being reinforced, as Evan said. That's on the reinforcement side. It does not go through downtown Seattle because those are hollow core, lots of hollow core column bridges that have no way of retrofitting. Not realistic to do through Seattle. So we've taken 405 and kind of turned that into the lifeline and did the 520 bridge across through to Seattle. So as you can see, nothing in Island County is on the seismic lifeline. So when we talk about a lifeline, it does not mean that it's not a lifeline to communities or it's not important to communities, and communities have their own lifelines. So I like to think of the seismic lifeline as the trunk of a tree, and we require help building the branches of the tree. So we have the start of it going. And then we are working with our partners, our locals, like Eric and our state emergency management division, to try to expand that in a sense to figure out how can we, not just seismically, but in any incident, right? How can we make sure that our supplies that are needed in a disaster are able to get to where they need to be to provide for our communities? Moving into the RGRAP, which is available online. It's the Region Resiliency Assessment Program, RRAP, which was a Department of Homeland Security project, is a report that came out using our bridge data that we have. They put it into this tool called the Bridge Seismic Screening Tool, and used a scenario of a Cascadia subduction earthquake. So this is worst case scenario, not most common scenario, not most likely scenario, worst case scenario. And in fact, worst case on Island County might not even be Cascadia. But it takes that scenario and comes out with an idea of what we might be looking at statewide. And it's not pretty, as you can imagine. So here's one of those big picture things, like Evan had. Red is bad on this. So as you see, there's a lot of red. Deception Pass is red. What this is showing is this chart. This chart is, it tells us out of all the bridges in the state, how long those bridges are going to take to repair after a seismic incident of 9.0, okay? This is if you're only working on one bridge. So one bridge will take 317 days. If you're working on, or sorry, 1 to 14 days. If you're working on all 317 bridges, that's not gonna be 1 to 14 days because we don't have enough people to work on 317 bridges all at the same time. So when it says six bridges are gonna take 2.5 years to reopen, realistically, that could be a decade. It could be a lot longer because we can't work on all of these bridges all at once, right? So we are looking at a very sad picture of the state after a Cascadia earthquake scenario, which I think all of us knew that's, again, worst case, very bad scenario. Not most likely to happen, but what we hope to prepare for. So taking this into consideration, we made this seismic lifeline to try and connect the federal distribution points. And I mean, suffice to say, Deception Pass is really not going to be a viable option in this. So we have waterways, right? Highways in the water with ferries. And you fortunately have NAS Whippy at your convenience here. But it's not looking very good in a situation like that. Now, in a more common scenario, a fire under the bridge, a lower earthquake level, something like that, Deception Pass is likely going to still be able to be used, utilities aside, that's a different conversation, with some repairs involved. So in that case, we have a preliminary damage assessment program that we have set up. This started as a little baby program, and now it is becoming this big, big program. It does not include specialty bridges. So something like Deception Pass, some random person can't just go, okay, Deception Pass is looking good today, right? You need somebody who really knows bridges to inspect something like Deception Pass or the floating bridges or the ship canal, something like that. But any just normal bridge, culvert, something that you drive over on your way to work, it provides us with a system to conduct assessments of those, very similar to like a windshield assessment for a fire department. We train as many of our employees as we possibly can. It's a 2-hour virtual training. It's based on NCHRP guidelines, which is like what the bridge engineers are required to do, but they're required to take like way longer intense classes. This is some baby scale of that. And really it's a rapid assessment of bridges to let us know, is it passable or is it not passable? Does it need a further inspection from somebody like Evan's group to come in? So we've kicked that off. We're now opening it to our partners. And the way that we have it is we have inspectors that go out, they deploy, they report to our area operation centers, which are our maintenance areas. And then they report up to our emergency operations center, where we then work with our statewide, our headquarters and our statewide partners. As I said, we are opening it to our partners. I've sent Eric the list, and I brought these for you guys, a copy to go around, in case you care. But we just had these created a couple of months ago to put in our vehicles for the people who are trained. They're not bridge inspectors, like real bridge inspectors. They have normal jobs that they're going to be doing. So this is like a quick guide for them out in the field. These are the things you should be looking for. So we can provide those to our partners as well. And we will get some people in as the program continues to develop. We'll get more and more people from the local groups in. And that also helps us develop those branches, right? So you guys are more familiar with your areas. You can gather that information, feed it all to Eric, who then feeds it all to the statewide partners. So we're all kind of going into the same system that way. We collect all the information using this form. This form is available publicly on our website. And this is really, they just fill it out and send it into the area operation centers. This is how we collect the information. and compile it, and then we enter it into a program for the state. And I did want to touch a little bit on emergency repairs. As Evan said, we are not well funded for a lot of things. So emergency repairs are becoming more and more common. And as disasters become more and more common, emergency repairs are becoming more and more common. And now with the federal government funding issues as well, we're running into even emergency repair funding issues. So I did want to just cover quickly, we don't have all the funding in the world at WSDOT. We do have to request assistance from our federal partners via Federal Highway Association or FEMA in a declared disaster situation. WSDOT does have the legal authority to declare a disaster within our own agency so that we can go to emergency contracting for repairs to get a quicker repair going. But a governor's proclamation is necessary for us to go after any sort of federal funding to recover, and that is a long, lengthy paperwork process. And eventually we get the money back. I don't know, people at headquarters deal with that later on, but eventually we get the money back. And as the finances are becoming more and more slim for both the state and the federal government, this is kind of becoming a more up in the air thing. Are we going to be able to get our emergency funding? And this is where my plug comes in for you guys. Work with your politicians, because that's the only way that we can get more funding to our systems. We don't have the funding to maintain. We don't have the funding for preservation. We're currently on emergency after emergency after emergency. So if you're able to push for transportation funding, that's really the only way that we can fix the situation that we're in. And that's my rainbow and sunshine presentation. Yeah.
Thank you. So what is it that Island County needs to do to convince the state to transition us from a general to a critical bridge? Because we are concerned, obviously, not just for our citizens, but for national security.
You know, I think it's a discussion. I think that's the starting point, is a discussion on it. It's interesting. So the three categories: critical, recovery, ordinary.
Ordinary, yeah.
Yeah.
We're ordinary.
These designations are relatively new, actually. So they're not necessarily in widespread use. So these three designations show up in the National Code for Bridge Design, and they've been there for several years, with just some vague criteria on what critical means, what recovery means, and what ordinary means. And from a design perspective, from a structural detailed design perspective, they don't actually give very clear definitions on what you do as a designer to meet each of those thresholds. They're just trying to give you some concepts. So it's only been in the last, probably decade that the bridge design community, and Caltrans has been a big part of leading out on this, is they're starting to put some clear criteria for us to those. So now that we have those, we're only now starting to use those designations. Typically, almost all the bridges, they're designed to ordinary. So if you design a bridge in today's world, design it to ordinary seismic standard, it's a much more robust seismic standard than we've ever used in the past. It's the state of the art in design. So even an ordinary bridge designed to today's standards is going to give you high confidence that the bridge is under a severe event, severe shaking, is going to be able to continue to stand. So we actually don't have any bridges that have been categorized in the state as critical. Even Tacoma Narrows Bridge, when we designed that in 2005 or so, at that time, we didn't designate that as critical because we didn't know what it was going to mean. So just to kind of give you a background on those terms, and we're doing our best now. Now, the Columbia River, I-5 over Columbia River, that we are we've and I see I've got a copy from the Bridge Design Manual. This is great. The next page after this page here gives clear descriptions on strain limits and all these technical details of how to reach a critical designation. But that I-5 over Columbia River, that will be a critical bridge. That'll be our first one. So the typical standard for us, if we're on a lifeline route now, and is, as Kayla pointed out, the lifelines will get a recovery standard. And recovery meaning that, thank you for this, recovery bridges serve as vital links for rebuilding damaged areas and provide access to the public shortly after an earthquake. So that would be probably where Deception and Canoe, I would think, might be the starting point. But I'm just, from an engineering perspective, not from a... I just want to give you a little background, but back to your question. I think it's a discussion. As it states in our design manual here, it's sort of a group decision that where we work with our executive teams, our region executive teams. So I think it's something that we could talk about. But I don't think there's not necessarily a formal process for it.
So. Okay, well, quickly.
The one thing I'll add to that, though, too, is the regional transportation plan lists this as a low priority, lifts the lifespan. And that's a decision of the council government, the executive board. And with that, as Evan said earlier, we have 300 bridges in the state that are over 80 years old. And so as we go to the state to advocate for to the legislature, or the legislature looks at what needs to be provided, I think that's one of the things they look at is, okay, we have 300 bridges, which ones, okay, this council government has said it's important. This one is prioritizing other elements, like ferries is what this board has determined is the priority. And so I think that's part of the discussion too, is what is the local priority? And if the local, if it's the will of this board that lifespan, lifeline should be a priority, then that gets the attention of the department and the legislature as far as funding goes.
So that's going to be a great conversation. One question real quick before we go to Janet. You said no bridges were critical. How many of the total bridges are in recovery compared to ordinary?
Just a handful. Several on the 520 route that you mentioned, and then there's been a couple probably on I-5. I would say less than 20 probably statewide.
Okay, out of 900 or whatever?
Over 3,000.
Oh,
yeah.
3,000.
Yeah, yeah.
900 are in the repair group. Oh, anyway, that's good enough.
Oh, you're talking about from the retrofit perspective.
That's fine. Yeah. So there's 3,000 bridges, and 20 of them are categorized as recovery. None are categorized as critical, and the other 2,980 are ordinary. Janet, it's your turn.
Thank you, Kurt. I just want to comment that having spent a lot of time listening to the transportation conversations and challenges last year, and I appreciated the comment about the role of our IRTPO, there was a lot in that transportation challenge funding we were talking about that addressed even the bridge you mentioned that isolated a community, and how do we do all of this in the balance of ferry funding versus bridge funding versus transportation funding versus pavement preservation versus all of this. So I hope our legislature, and I hope that all of us in this room, lean in on revenue solutions that help us to solve this problem. Because without revenue solutions, we don't have robust solutions for WashDOT or any of our transportation partners. Now my question. In the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, for the first time ever, they created a rolling application for bridge funding under the, let me look it up, Bridge Investment Program, Large Bridge Project Grants. If we prioritize this per what was said a moment ago in our IRTPO, would it help WashDOT be eligible for this rolling bridge investment program?
It wouldn't hurt anything to see this, the community prioritize this location, this bridge. It helps our discussions when we talk to the legislature, and I think it's a document that the legislators
use as they're looking at statewide needs.
So, Chris, do you know that I'm going to go to Jill next, but could, do you know whether that needs to happen, more beneficial happening at the Council of Governments or the IRTPO?
I think either way. I would tend to think the Council of Governments as the
makes overall, it makes sense. I wanted somebody else's opinion. I was thinking the same thing. Jill, you had a comment.
I'm sorry. Before you leave me, just a second. The next round of funding is due August 1st, 2025.
All right. Well, we'll talk about the action on that, Jill.
So I hear you. I heard all of it. I find it unacceptable. And here's when we're sitting here as community leaders, we are criticized for not having a plan. What's the replacement plan? I say all the time, there isn't one. There isn't one. Because that's what you just said. There is not one. There's not clarity on how to get prioritized. There's not clarity on where the funding coming from. There's not a plan that says if the bridge falls down, this is how we will design to replace it. I simply, now I'm a simple thinker and a linear. I don't understand why a replacement design can't be on the books already. And I understand, well, we don't know how it's going to break. We don't know. Yeah, I got all that. But let's design something to just simply replace it, right? Why is that not sitting on a shelf somewhere? So in an emergency, you pull it off and say, this is the plan. Even if the community knew that existed, that would be reassuring. But what we as local leaders are some, and local, and I understand we have state representatives and I understand the budget. I also understand that we came up with revenue because I just bought gas and I think I'm paying 4 cents more a gallon for failure. Respectfully, I'm not blaming you, but this is a bit of a, can I say shit show, or is that, you're going to rein me in on that? Molly's in charge of me now. I'm only allowed
helpful.
What am I doing?
This was a nice presentation, but doesn't get to the heart of what the problem is. Which is, we do have a Navy base where a majority of our pilots don't live on the island. I don't know if you're watching the news, but I'd say thank you to this Navy base, right? It's important. We can't get our pilots here because we don't have a bridge replacement plan. We don't have one for commerce. We don't have one for people. And I appreciate that we have ferries. I do. When you say that to us, it is literally like saying, well, Bellingham, you can drive all the way down to Everett to find your access point to get out of town. That's the 52 miles, right? You wouldn't allow 52 miles of failure on an I-5 corridor. And yet somehow it's fine for us because we're a cute little island. It's unacceptable to not be able to tell the community that there is some type of plan. And I do not understand why that design simply isn't done. Are we going to put a ferry in and redo the Hopus Point ferry docks? We're going to build two ferry docks and move people that way? That's a plan. Are we going to connect where we are now and tear down the thing and use the existing structure? That's a plan. This is not, oh, great. This is not a plan. And I think it is only fair to everybody at this table that we are able to say, hey, something's going on. But instead, we stand there and say, no, there's no plan. And by the way, it's going to be my fault. I'm the idiot. Don't interrupt me, Kirk. It's my turn.
Finish up.
I know nothing. I plan for nothing. I didn't see this coming. What are they paying me for? Why am I doing this? You're going to go to work. I'm going to lose my job. Because you don't have a plan, and all of the leaders here are telling you, you need a plan. Now, I appreciate you work for other people and there's a hierarchy, but this kind of intensity needs to get communicated around these kind of investments. I'm not asking for you to build it. I'm asking for you to have something on the shelf that tells you what you're going to do if it fails.
And I really appreciate that comment, and I'm with you 100%. And as you probably are well aware, we're not budgeted to sadly deal with being proactive. We're budgeted to deal with what the legislature provides for us. And so as Evan mentioned, the Carbon River Bridge, if that's the right term, we don't have a team specifically that was ready to go design there. The team that was designing 405, I-5, the Spokane corridor, they're being pulled off to look at that. I have my own bridge up here that's closed right now. I was just commenting to Evan, where's my designs? We don't have designers ready to take that on. We would love to, but the legislature doesn't provide for that. They provide for what we know, not what we would like. And I agree. I would love to have designs on the shelf, ready to go when an event happens for all these lifeline routes. The legislature doesn't direct us in that regard.
Okay, we're gonna stop. Senator Mazzal came in and he can speak whenever he wants to, but Molly, it's your turn to respond. I just wanted to introduce the fact that people that are Zooming in don't know that our senator just showed up, okay? So go ahead, Molly.
Just have a couple questions. When you say that our IRTPO does not list the bridge over ferries, so that's really what we need to do. We need to, there's only two ways to get on and off this island, and you're telling us we have to pick one and stick to it as a priority. If we start listing the bridge instead of the ferries, what does that do with WSDOT ferries for us? I mean, you're putting us in an impossible situation. I guess we just have to try and guess. I guess we have to guess which one would be more effective in a seismic earthquake.
In a disaster situation, advocate for both. I know that sounds crazy, but there is no way that we can't tell the future. We don't know what disaster is going to happen or how it's going to happen or when it's going to happen. It may be that the ferry dock isn't usable. It may be that the Navy base gets.
That's right.
Whatever, you know. One bridge is not going to solve your problem. There's a million other bridges that, not literally, but there's quite a few other bridges that you're required to pass over just to get to Deception Pass. So solving that one problem is not going to create a solution for you. Solving just the ferries problem is not going to create a solution for you. We have to advocate for the entire system to work as it's intended to.
Okay. And then,
that wasn't my intent to say you get one.
No, I know, but you're saying that I understood what you were saying and it was a good point, but it's like, okay, that we have puts us in a bad position. My second question is, that I would love to have answered once and for all. Don't want to put Brian on the spot, but you guys just said you have a base, kind of implying that we'll be taken care of because in an emergency because we have a Navy base here. My understanding is that is not what we are to assume, that we are to assume in an emergency, probably depends on what kind of emergency it is, I guess, we need to be prepared ourselves. And once the base takes care of their equipment and their people and their infrastructure, then they may be able to help us out. But we should not depend on the base to help us in an emergency. We need to take care of ourselves.
That is correct. And they take orders from not the cities, right? They have their own structure to take orders from, just like the ferries has to take their orders from the Coast Guard. So it's not something that you can rely on necessarily. However, they have that connection to the federal distribution system. It doesn't guarantee anything. It doesn't necessarily mean anything. It's just another thing to add to your
potential.
Potential. It's potential
list of resources.
Absolutely. And no community, this is not just the island. I grew up on Whidbey Island, by the way, so I get it. But I grew up down the road. No community can rely on the government to come in. We're not going to be able to rescue everybody. And that is just the sad reality of it. And that's why people like Eric and I have jobs, so that we can hopefully figure something out with our communities to be able to sustain themselves for shorter periods of time until we can get assistance to come
in. Okay. And I have one more comment to make, and this will get me in the newspaper for sure.
All right.
Who requested that you do a study on suicide prevention on Deception Pass Bridge? Who requested that? Really? Oh, rats. Man, he's right here. Okay. So I guess this is the part that's going to get me in the newspaper. If our bridges are in such horrible condition that you are only able to do emergency repair on all the bridges on the state, I feel like suicide prevention is a low priority. I know that sounds harsh. I know that sounds awful, but I would rather invest that money in the keeping of the function of Deception Pass Bridge for the hundreds of thousands of people that use it on an annual basis.
You want to speak to that, Senator?
When the time is right, that's for you to decide.
He doesn't need a microphone. You hear him? I'm sorry. Okay, well, the time's going to be right whenever you want to speak, but that was a very direct point. Is that the
idea that was you, Senator? So I requested that. I really did.
Yeah. So let's. I want to take as little time as possible here.
Take your time.
So this has been a reoccurring issue, but it is increasing, and it is increasing at an unsustainable rate. So let me clarify. First off, we as a society are going to be judged on how we take care of our children, our aged, and those who have critical issues. So I have to put that up front. Two, we've reached a point in time where suicides off from Deception Pass are at a 2-week interval, or suicide attempts. So when I got the whole group together last December, I had 2 fire departments, 2 sheriff's departments, state patrol, state parks, I think, and DOT. And we sat down out at Cornet Bay and in a big round table. And I just said, we're here to have a conversation. And we went around the room. When we got back to the end of it, I'd been having conversations with the Department of Transportation about this problem, which was getting worse. We got back to the end of it. I didn't insist on anything. At that point in time, Department of Transportation said, if we get together a budget for a study in engineering, would that help? And I said, you get the proposal together, I'll get the money. Backing up a little bit, I happen to have pretty close relationship with a member of the state patrol who unfortunately lost the hold on an individual who jumped off the bridge. Watching that individual plummet 180 feet to the water surface is not something you'd wish on anybody. I've had a long relationship with the fire department. You think finding a body is bad? Coming back to tell a family that they have no body to mourn and no closure at that juncture is worse. We've got a fire departments that are responding out there on a regular basis, and often we aren't finding the body. Last summer, I went off the island early in the morning, thought I recognized a vehicle, was bothered by that, came back, the vehicle was still there. Kid I grew up with, a few years younger than me, had jumped off the bridge that morning. I've had classmates jump off the bridge. So we have a behavioral health problem. But we've also got a sustainability issue with law enforcement in state parks, and with our fire department. As one of the chiefs said, I'm to the point in time I'm going to have to set up behavioral health treatment for my firefighters that are going out in the boat to recover bodies and to not. The day before Mother's Day, ling cod season's open, everything else, an individual jumped off the bridge and landed in between the boats in the water. Just so happened, there was multiple videos of that because people were out enjoying Deception Pass. County coroner had made contact with my office about that. And individuals who were not involved in it, who just happened to see that individual jump. Night before last, a daughter called law enforcement and said, my mother said goodbye. The only thing I can assume, she's on Deception Pass. Island County Sheriff's Department, State Patrol responded. Spent quite a bit of time. They finally found her huddled in the middle of the span against it. And when they got there, she tried to jump. They got a hold of her, handcuffed her, took her to behavioral health. This is not a once in a while. We've got people traveling from across the state to jump off a Deception Pass. We're reaching a point in time where this is not sustainable for emergency services, and it's not sustainable on a behavioral health side of things. And I blame social media, but it has become the place to end your life when you decide to leave.
So can I ask one question? Well, I can give it back to you. Is it my turn yet? I want to ask Evan a question regarding what Molly's question was, and thank you for your testimony, Senator. You talked about the fact that you're already sort of looking at design. You showed us a design on the Aurora Bridge that you might try and match if you're going to design. I mean, in terms of dollars and cents, the amount of money that you're going to spend on that, what comparatively would that do to fix another bridge in terms of its, you know, function and reliability?
Well, because we don't know how much it's going to cost or how, you know, what the solution might look like. That's why this study is just get of a starting point. That's been part of the challenge that we've had as DOT trying to support these questions from the community is we don't have an answer. They'll say, well, what would it cost to do this? What would it look like? And we say, well, we don't know. It's complicated. We're going to take some analysis. So that's what this study is going to do. It's just enough money for us to get in the ballpark of, okay, now we know the project.
So the only thing funded is a study.
Yep.
Okay. I got to move and some engineering.
Yeah, oh. There was a couple $100,000 of it was study and then engineering.
Okay. So I just to be clear, no money's going to be spent on the work on the bridge yet, but your comment is still resonating and you had a question. I'm sorry.
I do. So I'll just project. So my question is, I know you guys talked about risk assessment and looking at the different factors. If there were to be a tragedy on that bridge, and I'm not talking about earthquakes because we keep focusing on that, but let's just say it's 5 o'clock, bases are emptying out, it's a summer weekend, the bridge collapses. Not anything anybody wants to hear, and no, I don't want to be in the paper either, but in that instance, what is the risk to the state for the payouts we have to do potentially to address any need for people who are impacted by that? I'm talking summer tourist season. You got 100 people lined on each side looking out over the beautiful landscape. What is that risk? And have we comparatively looked at that when we think about this bridge and how it's utilized not just as a transportation tool, but also as a tourist tool that allows people to stand there, see the, you know, the vast landscape and understand it. And then you've also got cars driving across. So if that fails and we have some sort of situation like some of these other states, it's not just about repairing it. It's about the legal implications that we as a state have after that, because that's the other risk that we all have. And I know we all can say there's insurance and whatever, but there's more to that when we talk about our impact to our society that we have this bridge that have these potential risks. So I'm just curious if there's been any studies or comparisons or looks at what that risk is for us as well.
I just want to add one thing to what Sabrina just said, which is just FYI, Deception Pass Park is the most visited park in the state of Washington.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a wonderful point. And it somewhat gets back to the comment, why aren't we more proactive? But you can look at 10 years ago, the Skagit River Bridge on I-5 that went down. Mm-hmm. How do you really plan for any, whether it's Skagit, whether it's Ship Canal, whether it's in Vancouver, with all the infrastructures we have, how do you put the resources to plan for that type of thing? And then the type of event it is. You talked... is it just a structural failure, which would never happen? Or in the case of Skagit River Bridge, it got hit by another vehicle. What type of collapse? So there's just too many possibilities to be as proactive with the resources we have available as much as we'd love to. And so, yeah.
Jill, did you have a question?
Yeah. So in this, the state can't be proactive because it doesn't have enough money. I understand. And we'll get to you when we get to you because we have to put all these other bridges together first, which I also understand, but I'm not a Skagit County commissioner. So if people get to their bridge and it doesn't work, well, that's on them. So I'm just trying to get you out of the island, really. In that scenario though, we've had a lot of priorities. In fact, I would say a majority of this county's transportation priorities are on the state highway. Our safety problems are on the state highway. The roundabouts we need are on the safe state highway. The shoulder widening we need are on the state highway. All the things we're trying to do are controlled by the state. In this scenario, are we allowed to acknowledge what you just said and get our own plan and start finding our own solutions? Or are you going to say, we have to do it, it's our highway? Does it become our local problem to start solving? Because honestly, I'd rather take the responsibility and the consequence than take the consequence and have you sit there with responsibility and not do it. In an emergency, are we able to come up in it? Are we able to design an alternative plan? Could we pay for that? Can we do those things? Or we have to wait for you to get the money and then rank out against everybody else to do what is the most important thing to our county?
No, understanding that it is a state route, and so we are interested in making sure that it meets state significance, if you will. But local agencies are fine to do improvements on the state system.
Do improvements or to design improvements or do studies or what do you mean, Chris?
You need design to make sure it's structurally adequate and such, but it's very common. We see local agencies put structures over our highways. And so we always okay. have an interest in making sure that it meets all the safety standards we desire. But yeah, I don't see any reason that a local agency couldn't be the lead
go, in Molly.
Design and construction of a highway
Molly's going next now.
Wait a minute. Martin, I think, hasn't spoken, and he wants to, too.
I'll be short. I had, like, a two-part kind of sort of technical question about your presentation. You had this number scale, like, 1 through 8 of bridge condition, and then we've also been talking about this seismic rating of ordinary or not. And so part one is, like, how do those ratings fit into funding decisions of which bridges get prioritized, if at all? And then part two is, you talked about 15 or 20 bridges getting retrofitted a year, and then zero, and then zero. And I was looking at your projected poor condition chart based on current funding levels, and it was getting worse. And then around 2028, 29, it started to get better. Is there funding in the pipeline for in the 28, 29 timeframe for those things to get better? So kind of how is it prioritized with the ratings? And then what is the funding outlook? Are you guys going to redo this anymore, or is it just zeros from now on out?
Yes. So your first question is about how does the condition of the structure play into the prioritization of what gets done and what gets programmed. And it's one of the biggest inputs into that decision is the condition. So, we have sort of a machine, if you will, that's in place that helps us to get from understanding what our needs are to programming future projects. And the first part of that is the bridge inspection. So the bridge inspectors are identifying the condition of the inventory, and that goes into a database. We have a significant database, all 3,000 bridges. You can imagine each bridge has multiple elements on it. You know, concrete girder is, and each linear feet of concrete girder is put into a different condition states, condition state 1, 2, 3, 4. So we've got lots and lots and lots of data. So we have a bridge management system, and we have a team of people who go through, they collect all this data, and they use predictive modeling to identify what's going to happen with the overall inventory. What's the smartest way to spend our money to improve condition? And they can target. So if you told them, I'll give you this amount of money, I'll give you, or this twice as much or however much money, they can punch it in and they can optimize for whatever target we tell them. You want to reduce the percentage of poor bridges. You want to increase the percentage of good bridges, those kind of things. So that's really nice to have. Actually, it's a really powerful piece. And so what they do, our bridge management system does, is they create a list of recommended priorities or rankings of the needs based on condition. That then goes to our capital programs group. They're not bridge engineers. They're taking the information from across other groups in the state, the culverts, the roads, the all the other issues. And then they're looking at things other than just condition. They're looking at things like, what's the detour length? What's the sort of political ramifications and all these other challenges we have. And then they're using our starting point to come up with a program list. And then it goes from there to coordinating directly with the regions themselves. The region looks at this list and says, well, smarter for us to spend our money if we do this bridge this year and this bridge the next year, that kind of thing. So that, just to get you a sense to answer that question. And then your second question was about, the long-term projection. No, there's no funding coming in like 2028, 2029. That's just a result of this predictive modeling that it's going to tell you that some bridge, if there's probably a large bridge that would be, according to the prediction, that's got a large surface area, like one of the floating bridges that was going to be taken from like poor condition to fair condition at that point. So it kind of jumps around a little bit. So that's all that.
So in general, the funding outlook is...
The funding outlook is bleak.
For the bleak.
It's,
okay.
It's very... Yeah, yeah. No, we are marching down a path that we have been going down for years and years of underfunding our bridge needs. And it's going to get worse and worse. So we closed the Carbon River Bridge. There's going to be more bridge closures. And so that's part of the statement that I'm trying to make is that it's not going to get better unless there's a significant, we're still funded about for half of what we need right now for preservation and for maintenance. And it's been that way for years, and it's going to continue to get worse and worse. The only thing that can turn it around is a significant change in funding over years and years. It's going to take, if we got a significant increase in funding, it will take us a generation to dig us out of
the You money. Made that really clear earlier. Senator Mazzal, you have another comment?
No, the funding portion.
For the record.
So the funding, he is completely right. We are falling behind, and the cost of construction is going at an exponential rate. And how we are funding that through our Constitution, Chapter 18, whatever it is all gas tax. Now, we did negotiate part of the excise tax moving to DOT starting next year. That's between $1 and $2 billion a year just in excise tax and the sale of new vehicles. That should all be going into DOT, because the long term, as we're looking, the gas tax, even though we raised it 6 cents, it continues to decline. So we've got an unsustainable model in our funding for DOT, and we are already behind. And unless we do something, and this is why our transportation, we voted to, and I did vote yes to raise the gas tax, realize a lot of people are frustrated with that, but we also have to remember that a bunch of that cost is going to other things other than transportation. Carbon Commitment Act, none of that goes to transportation per se. What we consider, it goes to buses and bike lanes and that kind of stuff. So we have an unsustainable model. They're put in a position to try to do more with less all the time.
Well, and Evan made it very, very clear that if he had the money tomorrow, it might be 6, 8, 10 years before some of these projects got done. Go ahead, Molly.
So I'm supposed to be talking about bridges, but my mind is blown by the comment you just made. We've been endless conversations on IRTPO meetings, endless, about safety issues on Highway 20. Legitimate, real safety issues. And basically, what it all boils down to, the bottom line is, we're always told, you guys are little potatoes in the greater scheme of things for the state of Washington. Never has WSDOT said, you can go ahead and make those changes yourself. Mm-hmm. Never. We've all
there
been
is a process
under the thing that either you do it or it doesn't get done. And some of these are so serious, they need to be taken care of. And if we have to do the design and somehow find the money to do it, it's lives. It's lives on a monthly basis. Mm-hmm. I mean, but we've been told we're not.
Well, if we weren't told, we sure have always felt that way.
I do want to clarify that we can work together to do it's the thing is that you can't just go on the WSDOT right away and start working without notifying the WSDOT and working together on it. Now, if you come up with a project and you want to do a project, you know, Chris's team and our maintenance team would be happy to partner to figure out how we can work together to get it done.
Wow. Can you work together with us, though, in the same way? So I want to talk about this. Now I'm switching gears a little bit because my mom just brought it up this weekend as we were heading to Deception Pass, and she was talking about the potholes on it and the guardrails that are deteriorating, and it looks junky because, you know, the side things are falling down. And then she said, why are they putting that roundabout in at Fakima Road and Highway 20? First of all, it's the intersection down there that turns to the Navy base that is a bigger problem. Nobody here, no locally elected official, prioritized that on the highway. None of us think that's the highest safety priority, transportation priority, mobility priority. If you asked any of us, we wouldn't pick it.
It's not, we haven't even discussed it.
And yet, you're doing that. And now we're like, do you have money to replace the bridge? Do we have anything for this Broadway intersection? Why can't we widen SR20, which has been a 20-year priority of this board in tones probably more intense than this one? Because I'm in my charm mode right now. This is the charm. This is charm.
Choose charm.
Choose charm and choosing charm.
Keep it going.
But this is a hard community conversation to say major priority infrastructure things have no plan, and U-Haul gets a roundabout. What? Who's U-Haul?
Well,
so they have no liability. They, who cares?
So I'm assuming the Navy asked for the roundabout.
Wait. Let's let him answer the question. We didn't bring you in here to shoot these arrows, but you know what? It's worthwhile stuff. It's worth. Yes, I agree.
Mind-boggling.
I agree. Go ahead, Chris.
Wonderful. That's a great question. And Fakima is, it had nothing to do with the Navy. Fakima was a unique money distribution for low cost improvements. We have all these different pots of money, and it's a low cost safety enhancement. And so it was picked. We don't need any right of way there. We don't need to put down any widening. And so for that reason,
you know how you would have money for high cost priorities? You know how you could do the thing is by not spending all your money on the things nobody needs.
That's
and then
even on the IRTPO list.
We don't care about it. We care about the fact that there's no money to do a bridge replacement plan. Why can you not, maybe this is a legislative fix question, why can you not spend money on little things because it's easy money to spend, and save up your money to do high priority things?
Bet you have an answer to that too.
It's not how much money you have, respectfully. It is inability to prioritize big things.
Is it about the pots that they're in, or can I save you with that? I mean, what is it?
In my mind, it's about the pots of money that we have, the different codes. Now, I don't know whether they're legislatively appropriate, but the FACMA is from a unique safety pot of money. And we'll compare that to Honeymoon, where Honeymoon
thank
pay.
Thank you. That's where I'm thinking my head is.
We were millions short. We were allocated about $2 million. We determined it was in the $5 million, $6 million range to do that because of the unique grades and such. And it's like a six-legged intersection when you really get into it. And so it just didn't happen. Whereas Fakima is a unique set of money where we don't need to add any pavement. We don't need to buy any right-of-way. And we essentially... I don't want to make it as simple as we can paint a circle and we have a roundabout.
But Chris, has anyone died? Let's
keep.
How did we come up with that?
Well, I guess you asked us to be proactive. We're trying to be where we can at Fakima, and now I don't mean to be argumentative at all.
Could it be that the justification is that something got done as opposed to nothing getting done because you couldn't afford the ones that were more important? That's not good enough. I want to go back really quickly.
We're not. I know you want to go back, but
I just want to deal with the bridge a little bit more.
Well, we can't deal with the bridge because we're funding.
Because you can't get through FACMA to get to the bridge.
I can't, because I need all right. On my
go ahead in your charm mode and finish.
Because he is remodeling. I know, but Kurt interrupted me. I don't need a new microwave. I need a roof. And the connection that I'm making, Kurt, is that we are here to have a conversation about the fact that the roof has no replacement plan. And what I'm being told is there's no money to replace the roof. Well, here's how you get money to replace the roof. You quit buying microwaves, and you don't put new tile in your kitchen, and you don't put new countertops on your counter. What you do is you save your money for the roof, because the roof is where your brand new kitchen will reside under. That's what I'm trying to say. That was my connection to the bridge, is that it's easy to do something, but if something isn't the right thing, then it's not the thing that we should be doing. That's all I'm
trying to say. And I won't give the cute little kitchen example. I wonder why we're spending hours and hours and hours in executive board IRTPO meetings, and our staff is spending hours in IRTPO technical meetings when WASDOT is just going to come out and do random stuff. I mean, I'm seriously just gobsmacked that this has happened.
When they gave a presentation on it, they did tell us that they were doing it.
Oh.
So anyway, I just want to put the roof on the house.
All right.
Can I just to keep going on this? We're not doing nothing. We are looking at the Ryan's house situation. I'm sorry, it's not moving faster.
I forgot about that one. I'm thinking of two other ones.
Limited living. We're looking at that. Sorry, it's not moving faster, but we do take the safety priorities that are in the transportation plan. We do take what's coming from the RTPO meetings. Yeah, we are looking at those.
You know, it's funny though, at the IRTPO meetings, we had this very same conversation, and our transportation planner said, well, we got to follow the state's plan. We can't help you solve Libby right now. So, and you're saying it's the other way, kind of saying it's the other way around. So I'm going to stand confused on that. I don't know if it's just because we have so many plans and there's a lag between what the local IRTPO wants done and whether or not it gets on the state plan. I'm confused by that. I want to ask a question of Evett and Senator Mazzal. So the $200,000 you got for engineering for the bridge? Okay. You said part of it was engineering. Here's my question. You said part of it was engineering. I was wondering if there's going to be some other benefit than suicide prevention with that engineering. In other words, if you got to bolster something up in order to put that up, would there be maybe a side benefit? I'm just trying to see if there's more than just one thing.
So just to give you an idea of the proviso, it was $900,000, $200,000 for a study. The remainder should cover engineering and what the study decides. And these aren't my numbers. This is what DOT gave me. The idea, if it was to go forward, just a rough estimate, that it could be upwards of $5 million, all of that included, study, engineering, and the actual construction on that.
Evan, is there a benefit to the bridge?
What do you mean?
Benefit to the bridge?
A structural benefit to the bridge. In other words, would it allow for an opportunity to kind of relook at what's there, and maybe there's going to be a benefit that wouldn't otherwise happen?
Oh, like is this by putting in the fence, would we somehow provide some other strengthening or seismic retrofit or anything?
Good question, yeah.
Yeah. I suppose it's possible. Okay. I don't expect it to. The nature of the work would be up, more than likely up high in the flooring system. Any of the strengthening we have to provide to support the fencing will probably be up high. And the seismic retrofit's going to be further down in the superstructure. So okay. I doubt we would try to do both.
Fair answer.
But yeah.
All right.
As a side note, none of this project funding is related to things like potholes. That's a totally different fund, general maintenance fund. I'd be happy to talk general maintenance.
Okay, Brian.
Arlene's concerned about the
files. Brian has, Arlene aside, Brian has a question.
Yeah, I just want to make a couple comments here real quick, just because a lot of conversations talked about the Navy and obviously the importance and the connection with the bridge. Kind of, to Molly, to your point, and to emergency management piece, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why we do try to get together. That's why we have our emergency management connected with Island County's emergency management, so we can plan. Every year we work on Citadel Rumble, like what are we going to do in a contingency operation, right? Yes, while there are certain components of our mission that we probably won't be able to support with, there are other ones we might be able to. And that's why we continue to want to keep marching forward as we work together in those plans. So. With that said, I think there's more to happen and more conversation that we can continue to have in how we can most likely support. But you're right, it's going to be directed from top down. And most likely our connection with Washington Military Department and how that's all going to work in terms of a Cascadia event. The other thing too I want to mention is going to come in terms of funding. I know the conversation here has been kind of planning and what do we do moving forward, but I want to throw these two things out for WSDOT. Are you able to, I mean, can you guys apply for grants at the federal level for specific projects, right? So, I mean, say that the seismic retrofit study said, hey, here's where Deception Pass sits, but it's way down the line in our priorities, but we can go get grant funds for it if there's an opportunity. Would you guys have that opportunity? I mean, you guys have grants writers and can do it. I'm going to throw this out there. So the Office of Local Defense Community Cooperation, the federal funding arm that funded two brand new schools in Oak Harbor, has a plethora of programs, right? Now, we don't know the status of what federal funding is going to look like through that program. We do know that they are intending to continue to fund certain programs, but the Defense Community Infrastructure Program might be one. If WSDOT already has a study that says, here's what most likely would need to be from a retrofit standpoint, and we have a shovel-ready project ready to go, WSDOT could apply for that. And if it's a couple $1 million, they might be able to get that. So and I say that the reason why it might happen is because of the fact that NASWB Island and Highway 20 are on the stray net connector, right? The same reason that we used to do the ferry component, the ferry piece has been dropped off the stray net, but Deception Pass is still a connection. So it is a critical network for us. So I'm throwing that out there. I can provide that information on how we can do it. Unfortunately, I think the grant for this year's round ends in like a week, but it will come up again next year. But the fact that there's already a study in existence could help that argument, and it would be really easy to do that grant. So I throw that out there. The other one too, when we start talking about other studies at the local level, Old CC also has installation resilience funds. Those are in a state of flux right now on how they're gonna be funded, but they could also be used for future planning studies. If we wanna do like a holistic network planning study, if we wanna look at, you know, cause like Kayla, you mentioned a perfect example, right? Deception Pass is one thing. Yeah, but what about twin bridges? And we got to get the whole connection out to I-5, right? To get us back to the stray net. So we could potentially maybe look at tapping into the IR funds, the insulation resilience funds, to maybe look at a corridor study. What would it take to get us to be part of the rest of the federal connection? So, and I think there's more to that conversation too, because of Joint Base Lewis-McChord's C-17 logistics compared to, and our airfield probably makes us part of that network without actually having Highway 20. But depending on the seismic event, we don't know whether airfields are going to be operable or not. However, that is part of the conversation, most likely. So that's probably why you don't see some of us connected the way that we normally would. But I'm throwing them out there because they are potential federal dollars that we might be able to use.
Brian, who specifically should we be connecting you with at the state or in the county?
Who at the state would
you give me my card, okay. And we can connect, yeah, on the disaster grant stuff. Mm-hmm. Not, we can work with Eric, yep, as well.
That's, yeah, all. Brian, that was charming.
That was great.
Choose charm. Yes.
Yes.
But let me just, I'm sorry, ask a downer question. I'm assuming that these projects then would have to be, you'd have to tie the transportation aspect of it back to the base.
Yes. I mean, all those have to tie to the installation.
So like safety issues in Coopville or South really won't probably rank for this type of money.
They could. It all depends on the scope. But yes, they would be lesser compared to, especially this one has a stray net tie. I mean, NASWB Island is connected Highway 20,
yeah,
via Deception Pass Bridge and the Twin Bridges to the stray net. Okay. That's an Army designation. So that is a lot stronger than, yes, mm-hmm, other. We do have connections that we could do in Central Whidbey with OLF Cooville. There's other things we could do. But this one is a, no kidding, I think would probably be a really strong support. Absolutely.
So what do we do to make sure these conversations keep going? I mean, it's not a one and done here.
I'd like to invite Brian to come back and give a more cogent and materials presentation on this topic. Can we talk about that when we get to other topics of interest at the end of the meeting?
Would you be willing to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Great. No problem.
Okay, thank you, Janet. All right. You know, how much time do we need for our CEDF?
Jill, how much time do we need for our CED, do you think?
Probably like an hour, 45 minutes to an hour.
Okay.
What? IRTPO.
No,
Rural County.
Rural County.
RCEDF.
Oh.
It's on the agenda.
For today.
No.
Just a few minutes.
I think. Okay, all right. That's all I wanted to know. I'll give you. Okay, but hang on a second. All right. We'll give you 10 minutes. We'll somehow do that. I don't know how. We didn't get to, utilities. I want to at least touch on the utilities that are coming across that bridge. I mean, even, granted that we're going to lose freight and mobility, but what utilities cross that bridge? What critical utilities? And how much water is it, and what percent of that water is necessary for, like, the base and the city of Oak Harbor?
100%. All of it.
Pretty much the city and the installation.
Anything that's 100%. Not on well.
Okay, so, and is that, and maybe, Evan, you know this, is that through, like, a one-foot steel pipe that's hanging under the superstructure? So is there a power line that comes under there as well?
No,
that, or is that in a separate location? Okay, power lines east of the bridge. What's that?
They attempted to put fiber through it, the wet fiber from Anaforis, but they stopped it.
Oh, they were going to go through the water line. Yeah, that new process where you can take your fiber through it.
I believe there's a 12-inch and a 10-inch main that come across the bridge. 10-inch is older. The 12-inch, I think, is a little bit newer.
Okay. All right. So somebody was saying something about other problems. You know, I could see, like, if fuel trucks were even allowed across the bridge, but if one jackknife and we had a heck of a nice fire going and there were some other issues, we could see interruption of utilities that we could maybe repair the bridge deck, but how long are we going to be out of water? And is there a plan for that? I'm curious. And if there isn't a plan, we probably don't have time to talk about it today. If there's a plan, I'd like to know where it is. If there isn't, maybe we'll have another meeting based on that. Is there a plan that, Eric, maybe you know, or Kayla?
Thank you. So really what we were doing was identifying the different wells and stuff that we have on the base and or that the Navy base has, as well as the city of Oak Harbor has, in order to augment that water system until it's back up and running.
I mean, it's more than the base. It's 22,000 people on that water supply, right? That's half of our island population almost is on that water supply. So, and there's some places it serves in the county before it gets to the city. So there does need to be now you're not in trouble, we're in trouble. You'll enjoy this. We do need to have a replacement plan somewhere that says how we're going to connect that and get that water to all of those people. Or we need to know how we're barging in the water. But that's not a little thing, and that plan should be somewhere. Who's got that plan? It's an Oak Harbor Navy County plan.
Well, and the thing is, I know enough about water to be kind of dangerous, but there are new technologies. Oh, yeah, I thought that was, I thought that was rhetorical. Go ahead.
I did not always give my opinion. That was an actual.
All right. That was a question. Does anybody have the answer?
If I could. Yeah. Yeah. Bringing in water from the outside is in our ESF6, which is, emergency support for, mass services, mass support for the public.
And we hold that plan?
Different ways. We hold that plan in our comprehensive emergency management plan. However, we have emergency wells that are located with the city of Oak Harbor. That would be our first option in order to bring larger amounts of water in.
And okay, so the Oak Harbor holds that plan?
For the emergency wells, yes. For restoring water to the city of Oak Harbor, and it'd be to the Navy base.
Correct. And we have our emergency, we have our reservoir that has whatever capacity it is for a certain amount of time. And then I do believe we have backup wells that we can do, but we have our emergency management plan too. But that's the reason, like Eric was talking, that's why we work together to make sure how do we marry up each individual plan to make those connections.
And the neighborhoods that are on the city water that are outside of the city, so there's an entire neighborhood up by Deception Pass, I believe, that gets water from this pipeline. we have a plan for that neighborhood or we don't have a plan for that neighborhood.
The water that's supplied across the bridge goes to the city of Oak Harbor. So that's part of the city of Oak Harbor's plan in order to distribute water to these neighborhoods.
Yeah.
If it's something that can't be supplied via the emergency wells, that's when we would bring additional water in from the outside, whether it's via barge, whether it's via, you know, truck, any of that stuff.
We have an interlocal agreement with them that says that they're providing water to these county residents, or it's part of the water distribution plan that we have right now.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I have not seen an interlocal agreement or a document for those county folks north of Oak Harbor. So I guess that's the piece that I would just want you to
Because right now the water coming across the bridge goes to Oak Harbor, and the city of Oak Harbor distributes it to the Navy base, as well as any other neighborhoods that are being supplied water from that system.
Yeah, I just want to make sure as well. So I think we should just confirm that and then make sure that we're all on the same page.
Because the same lecture I just gave about why are we not being proactive and telling people that if something does go wrong, there is a plan, applies to us as well, especially about things that we can control. So there is absolutely no reason that we do not know how we're going to provide water to citizens in a situation where our water primarily comes across a bridge that we just talked about could go down in a certain scenario that we believe is highly unlikely in our lifespan. I'm going to put that in there just to calm people down.
Highly likely.
My comment was more about the fact that the water could be interrupted without the bridge going down. But anyway, the conversations are worth having, and it seems one more reason, I guess, Eric, to have a complete area emergency plan. Molly?
When you guys are classifying bridges and talking about their prioritizing them, is something like a major water utility on the bridge, is that taken into consideration or not, because that's not your part of the bridge?
For the bridge management system and prior, our ranking does not account for utilities. Okay. Typically.
So there's a franchise agreement that allows the water, whoever that service is, to cross the bridge. Mm-hmm. So it's just like any other franchise agreement. And, you know, there's communication on that bridge too, right? I mean, you know, there's, I don't know, is there wires? No.
I don't know. I'm looking at the bridge inspection report.
No phone lines, no fiber lines, just water. Okay. This has been a great conversation. I'm really glad we brought you all to Council of Governments. I think we're all learning. I think that's what Council of Governments is supposed to be for. So I'm really pleased. It was an honor to have our senator sit in with us as well. Some very heartfelt testimony that we can probably all learn from as well. Unless there's more super pressing on this issue, we'll try and come around again and not make it a year, okay? And we'll have another conversation. And maybe by then we'll have a local plan of how we're going to help try and fund some change to that bridge, right? I mean, we have the right to do that. We didn't know that. But is there more questions? All right. Thank you all very much. We're going to move on to the next topic. That was great. Yeah. I know. I like that. 10 minutes here, 15 there, right? You did well with all this, Chris. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
And Evan was great. Thank you.
Well, but others will probably be at the
table. Actually, we're going to finish this meeting by talking a bit, and this may not apply to you, but we're going to talk about your rural county economic development funds. We had that on our agenda here, and I want to know who wants to lead that off.
So Cody Bakken.
One should
bring Cody up.
So is, yeah. Can you do that, Megan, for me?
Cody's online. Cody? Oh. He's here.
Hello. I apologize. I wasn't able to be there in person today.
Yeah, Cody, we have 15 minutes.
Understood. So my name is Cody Bakken. I'm the ARPA broadband coordinator. I also handle the Rural Economic Development Funds. And just a quick rundown on the program to begin with. We have a fund of about 9.3 million. There's about 3 million that are currently obligated with prior projects going back to as far as 2018. And that means there's about $6.2 million in the fund currently that is unobligated. This year we did the program, the grant window a little bit later than preferred just because there was a changeover in the staff who was handling it. I had to get up to speed. And so we did the grant window March 24th through April 30th. I sent out notifications to all of the standard applicants that we've had historically, as well as with the permission of the board, included a few more entities that should be qualified and eligible to apply. And we only got three applications. Two of those applications, well, there were four applications. One was not completed, and so it's not considered a full application to move forward through the process. Two of the applications were for entities that are not technically eligible, and so we're looking into getting a complementary pairing sponsorship with an Island County department to make that go through. Those discussions are ongoing currently. And the last one was from the Port of Cookeville. And so that's where we're at. The commissioners asked that I bring this information forward to you so that COG could be aware that this program is here and that we need to kind of look into what were the situations, the factors that led to not very many applications coming forward, and to kind of check in with the other governments about what's going on. So I'm here for your questions, and I know that there's probably some questions that are going to boil forward in just a moment.
Okay, thank you, Cody. The questions?
So to add on to that a little bit, we just finished that SEDS report, right, which is the economic development plan for the county. Each entity has goals associated with the SEDS. Each entity has barriers that are keeping them from achieving some of those economic goals. Any of those types of projects that are infrastructure related are already identified as potential 0.09 fund grant opportunities. And so what I would encourage is for each entity to look through the SEDS, which we all committed to being our economic development plan for the county, that we're all making sure that our economic goals are in the SEDS. I would recommend looking through that and seeing if there are infrastructure related expenses that could be eligible for these funds, because that's the job creator document that we have. And so sometimes it's hard, I find it hard when we're sitting in our county meetings to think economically, because I'm thinking about, like, I'm thinking about roads with road funds, or I'm thinking about a bridge study with road funds, but maybe a bridge engineering plan or study is an economic development fund. But going through that SEDS and seeing what it triggers in you, that might be where we find economic projects that are suitable for that particular grant fund. And I don't think the plan is to necessarily reopen it unless we start hearing from partners that, okay, wait, I see something that I can do. But just to kind of get everybody thinking for maybe the next round, that those projects are identified somewhere.
The next round would be next April then?
Probably next April. As we review those SEDs, people are like, oh, wait a second, this is something we can do sooner. I think we're open to those ideas, but it needs to be associated with that SEDs work a little bit. The money's there. We're just not getting the projects that are in alignment with our economic goals.
Wait a minute.
Isn't it 0.09?
Martin, hang on. And remember, the state legislature made that available for workforce housing as well.
We agreed at our thing, though, that it was infrastructure only related to that housing. So
okay. Good to know.
We have a lot of money to build. We don't have a lot of infrastructure.
But you do, we could fund infrastructure to get the building going.
Right.
And maybe even preliminary engineering.
Is
that infrastructure?
I mean, it's a private developer that's going to be doing all that. So it depends on how many public funds you want to put towards subsidizing a private developer.
If it's a private developer. Martin?
Since I'm the newest here, I think, could Cody or maybe somebody else in the room just kind of describe what this, just the minimums and maximums this grant could be applied for? What are the eligible entities or ineligible entities? And what's the general, I mean, aside from just general economic development, are there any other guidelines of what kinds of projects we should be looking at?
Yes. So first of all, the eligible entities would be the public entities, governments, the ports, and other special purpose districts. So that's pretty much everyone that's in the room right now, and a few other entities that don't normally participate in COG. The funds can be used for capital projects of public facilities that create or protect jobs long-term. They can be used for construction of affordable workforce housing infrastructure or facilities. Generally, that's going to be something public use. And then we can also use the funds for an economic development personnel. Currently, we use the funds to help fund the EDC, the Economic Development Council of Island County, and they do work in helping bring companies into Island County, promoting job growth and other such things. They don't really handle anything that is capital project oriented. So that's what this grant fund program is more for, is the capital project. That's how we have the policy currently designed for Island County.
Cool. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Cody. Janet.
Just, I think that it's infrastructure, but it's important to remember there's a nexus to jobs. So it's not just any infrastructure. It has to have a nexus to jobs. And that's why it has the economic development piece. Mm-hmm. And I think everything Commissioner Johnson said about, you know, going to SEDS, looking at what you have, but just remember, it's not for any infrastructure project. It has to have a nexus to jobs and economic development.
And I'd like to follow that up by connecting with the SEDS. So the Comprehensive Economic Development Strategy is a document that was adopted by Island County last year with cooperation with the other municipalities. And that has a list at the end of all the projects those different entities have at that point identified as being projects that they could probably bring forward. Now, that does not limit the projects that can be applied for to only what's listed in the SEDS. There are other ways to include projects. They have to be in another planning document or something similar to that, but there are other documents that can be used instead of SEDS. Now, the other part of that is that this list of projects is going to change. And as a government goes through their process and they see that something has come up with a higher priority or something else has come up and they need to deprioritize a project or realize that it's not going to necessarily be a project that way and they need to remove it from the list, that is part of our SEDS monitoring that we need to do. And the EDC Executive Director Christina and I are both working on a contract for that monitoring process currently. And we'll get that in place probably, I want to say early August is my hope, just with our contract review and everything. So part of that contract would be that the EDC checks in with the different governments that are on the list of projects, and we would then work to update that list and get that list formally published so that when this program goes forward again next year, current policy is for the window would start in February so that it could be completed before June. We would have that list updated and the projects would be more current as to what's going on. So it's not just like a once every year or once every other year kind of thing, but more of every few months, what's the list look like? And then we can come forward to the board to make that list formally updated and more accurate.
Okay, I'm going to wrap you up. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. the key is if you have staff and you're going to make application, figure out what's eligible, because it's not that difficult. All right. Thank you for that, Cody. I think you did a great job.
There's one thing he didn't include. So, Cody, Martin asked, what's the maximum they can request?
There isn't currently a maximum in our policy. It's a 50-50 funding model. So the project would be 50% funded by the program and then 50% by the applicant or however else they're able to bring that forward, unless there is a determination by the board at the time of application otherwise.
Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Is that enough for the RCEDF right now? The window will open again next spring, it sounds like. So maybe there'll be more discussions. Look into it. It's a good opportunity. There's some money there. I would like to move. Oh, did you have a comment?
That was actually the question.
All right. I'm sorry. I'd like to move quickly into other items of mutual interest. I wanted to go back around to the idea that we don't necessarily need to have council of governments every month, and maybe not IRTPO every month. Maybe instead we alternate or we do quarterly. And I'd like to have a discussion because it's hard limiting both to an hour, for example, or an hour and a half or whatever it ends up being. And it seems like it should be. This has been a great conversation today. It was a great topic, and it was going to take more than an hour. So thanks for extending that, whoever helped to do that. Any discussion about that? Like, for example, do we need to have Council of Governments next month? I would really like to bring in the executive director for Washington Public Ports, maybe in August, because that's when he said he could come. And I'd love for him to describe not specifically any particular item, but the benefits and the drawbacks and the taxing abilities of port districts, and give us a rundown. That would be like in August. Do we need something in July? I mean, we've had these conversations. I'm not the only one that sat here and tried to get a presentation together every month. I think some of the other former chairs can appreciate this. Why don't we skip next month and do August? And if there's more that Malcolm or Jill or somebody needs from IRTPO, we can hold a longer IRTPO next month, or maybe we skip that. What do you think?
My opinion is that I think that we probably could skip COG. We don't have to do COG every month. I think there's a lot that IRTPO should be doing that we're probably not doing. I, at this point, would hesitate to not do IRTPO every month.
I mean, my thought is similar-ish. I think that right now we're in a year, so we should just kind of make the decision about what we need to do each month. If we don't need IRTPO, we say it, but there needs to be some coordination between IRTP and COG. So if we don't need IRTPO, that's a good month to have a longer COG meeting. If we have a very robust IRTPO agenda, then maybe we don't have COG. But we don't have to do everything every month ineffectively because we have limited time. I think coordinating between them two meetings and the ILIO and say, okay, who's doing what so we can allocate time appropriately. I think that's been part of our tension, is everybody's trying to fill the time, but it's not enough. Like, this was a good conversation because there was enough time to have it. So my thought would be that we get with Malcolm and IRTPO and figure out what his decision schedule is and how much time he needs for that. Then we can plan the COG meetings kind of around that, because this group is not deadline driven like IRTPO is. And then we can figure out from there some more robust conversations.
The only deadline requirement is if you're reaching out a month or two and you're trying to schedule somebody, you know.
Well, that's right.
Presentation.
You need to sit down and plan out the year. There should be nothing.
Okay, I like that.
There should be no deadline coming up for IRTPO that they're not aware of.
So the chair of the COG and the chair of the IRTPO should actually sit down and try and hash out the best schedule possible. But I wanted to know if you all were open to considering that. And I would like to see if I can have Eric Fitch from Washington Public Port here in August. Right.
Kurt, I just want to remember that predictability is sometimes hard in scheduling. So we heard from the county, but we didn't hear from our other partners. Perhaps Megan can send a follow-up email on this issue to see what everyone thinks in terms of the predictability of having it every other month, or whether folks feel like it's okay to flex based on demand. I think that's something we can certainly follow up with by email. We also had a request, as you and I talked about last week, from ARCIC to present to this group sometime this year. So maybe we could put together as well a list of who's offered to present and any interest. This was, I think, an extraordinarily good meeting because of the time allowed to do a good meeting.
Yeah, well, thank you, Janet. You and I will meet before I meet with Jill. And
I'm flexible. I don't mind being flexible month to month with canceling or whatever.
You know, I think if everybody here knows that they're going to have one meeting or the other, their brain's going to know that the last Wednesday of the month you're going to come here and you'll wait to see whether it's going to be IRTPO or Council of Governments. I think we can figure that out.
We should be able to get a schedule.
Yeah, we'll figure it out.
A new schedule for 2026. I'm like, oh, 2026. And we should be able to map it out a year in advance, I think.
I think, well, close enough, like you say, and still roll with it. I mean, we all get emails and we read them, I hope. Is there any more items for mutual interest? Okay, this meeting's adjourned. Thank you.